Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. This week, VPR is airing a new 7-part series from Erica Heilman of the podcast Rumble Strip. It's called They Are Us, and it explores the mental health system in Vermont, featuring the voices and personal stories of multiple Vermonters.
Right now in the state of Vermont, 1 in 20 Vermonters are living with a serious mental illness. Could be a major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. These are not just occasional days of feeling blue. These are more persistent challenges that get in the way of managing everyday life.
Today, we're speaking with some of the people heard in the podcast for a discussion. We're going to talk about what it's like to live with a mental illness or have close family members with mental illness, how to seek care, and how we all can work to better help and support those of us who face these serious challenges. We're joined by Sarah Holland. She owns the Rivers Bend Design Landscaping Company in Moortown, and she has lived with major depression since her early 30s. Now she's on the board of Washington County Mental Health Services. Also with us is Ron, who is the parent of an adult son with schizophrenia. We're just using Ron's first name to preserve privacy for his son. And Louis Josephson is with us. He's president and CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat. He joins us from our studio in Brattleboro, and we should disclose that the Brattleboro Retreat is an underwriter for VPR. I want to welcome all three of you to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Sarah, I'm going to start with you.
Sure.
Can you tell us about when your depression started?
My depression started about the age of 33. I had just had my third child, and I was I was basically not feeling. That was my what I trained myself to do in order to get to 33, and so it was all new to me. I didn't know what was happening.
When did you realize that this is more than having a bad day, a rotten week, a rotten year? I mean, that this is depression.
I started losing my ability to function every day. I started drinking more alcohol, beer, which was very unusual. And so I knew something was happening. And but I just got so I was very, very capable person and very practical. And but I was I was finding it difficult to do what I do every day.
Ron, your son has schizophrenia, and I want you to describe what that really means, how his personality has changed from the son you knew before.
Well, someone wrote that it's like you're driving in your car and there's a storm and the fog and the sun starts going down. And before you know it, the fog is getting deeper and deeper. And the road signs are harder and harder to detect. And then sooner or later, you get scared because all those markers that you relied on for all your life are gone. And it's a very scary atmosphere for somebody that has a very serious illness, especially schizophrenia. But by no means, that's not the only one.
How old was he when this started to happen?
Well, typically schizophrenia is, you know, from 18 to 25 range is where it strikes the most. My son's case, we really noticed it at 21.
Do you or his doctors know what brought it on?
You know, stress is a huge, you know, you're going through adolescence. You know, you're in sports. You may get cut from the team. All those little things start to add up. And, you know, if a person is into marijuana or other things because they feel like, oh, I need something, you know, to self-medicate, And then you start to get isolated, and you know something's up.
Louis Josephson, these are very personal stories. How do they fit into the landscape of mental health in our state and the challenges that people face?
Well, Sarah and Ron's stories are very familiar to us at the Brattleboro Retreat, and we have tremendous compassion for individuals and families who are struggling with mental illness. But as you said earlier, about 1 in 20 Vermonters are going to have a mental illness in any given year, and that's you and me and our neighbors and the people in the grocery store. So it's a common illness. Part of the problem, though, I think that we have here in Vermont is, in terms of a crisis in our system, is that we're not having enough services to meet the needs of families and individuals with mental illness. And when I talk about that, I really mean a robust continuum of services from outpatient counseling all the way through to inpatient services. And we find that some people are kind of stuck at different levels of care and can't move through the system. So if you imagine somebody in a medical facility and they had surgery for, you know, a broken leg and they needed to go to a rehab facility, but there was no rehab bed and the person just languished in the hospital week after week at the wrong level of care, we see that type of thing, the mental health equivalent of that, too frequently here in Vermont.
Well, we do hear a lot about that, about not having the requisite services, but how do you and what do you say to people to convince them to seek care for mental illness?
Well, I think that's really a question for us in society in terms of prevention and awareness building. And I think one of our big challenges still is the stigma of mental illness. We know that people are out there suffering, but they're ashamed. Their families are ashamed to come forward to ask for help. And I would love to see, and I know the state of Vermont has made some steps in this direction, is to have a more comprehensive system that starts in medical homes and primary care that can identify a potential mental illness with a provider, a doctor or a nurse that families and individuals feel comfortable with as a way of breaking down stigma and getting people into needed services early on.
Well, Louis, we know we have, you know, gaps in the system, and we'll talk more about that. But, you know, what is available and how can people who need that care get access to it now?
Well, we do have a mental health system here in Vermont, even though we would love to see it improve. Mm-hmm. And so there's a range of services. The designated agencies are the 10 community mental health centers geographically scattered around the state that are really the front line for people who want to get services for themselves or a loved one. And then after that, if people need higher levels of care, we do have some residential services. So people who need a supported situation to recover from their mental health issue, we have that. And then we have inpatient psychiatric beds at the retreat and other hospitals around the state. The state has now passed some legislation last year with some funding for us at the retreat to expand 16 adult beds to add some capacity to the system. The UVM Health Network is looking at adding beds at Central Vermont Medical Center. So there is some motion to add some capacity in the system right now.
Go ahead, Ron.
I just want to add, when people are as parents, we're looking at our loved one, and we don't want to recognize that maybe there's a problem, and we say, oh, this is just part of adolescence or whatever. It's growing pains. I would urge people out there that if you're on the fence and want to know more, go to a NAMI meeting. They're all over the state. And you'll see people with similar stories. You know, everybody's head will shake. Yes, that's happened to me. And you'll be able, and you don't have to contribute. You know, you can just sit on the meeting, sit there and leave at the end. But it'll give you some insight on what is, you know, indicative of mental illness and what is not.
Yeah. Sarah, did you have any reservations seeking the appropriate care when you knew you had severe depression?
Yeah. So it's great to hear the list of all the services. And they, a lot of them, there's a lot more today, but a lot of them were available to me. But it meant in order to get to that point, I had to feel some hope in myself. And I also had to feel accepted. I was keeping a major secret since I was 6 and 7 years old about the abuse, the rape that happened to me. I had gotten really good at keeping a secret and showing to everybody how I was okay. So there could be services out there, but whether I feel I have to be able to feel accepted, and I need to be able to accept what's offered to me.
What was it at age 33 that convinced you that I have severe depression and now is the time for me to seek help?
It was self-medicating, drinking. It was not being able to go to work and high anxiety. That was probably what was interfering with my functioning, with taking care of my kids and being a part of the family.
Connie Stabler, like Ron, is the parent of an adult son with schizophrenia. And in They Are Us, she describes one of the first times her son showed signs of serious mental illness.
I remember sitting down with him one time, and I don't know what precipitated it, but I probably asked him what was going on. And that's when he told me, and I remember we were out on the porch and he was pacing back and forth and saying, you know, I'm on a mission from God, and I don't know what it is yet, Mom, but it will be revealed to me. I've received this gift, and there's nothing wrong with me. I've just received this gift.
Ron, has your son sought and received the appropriate care for his schizophrenia?
Well, it's been a roller coaster because in the beginning, he you know, I knew something was wrong, and I would ask him, you know, can you tell me about it? And he just could not come out and tell me what was going on. He just said, you know, it's a big deal, but I have to figure it out myself. And I look back on it now, and he was probably dealing with voices that he really had no clue how to handle. And that's where you really need outside help. It's bigger than you. It's way bigger than you. And you really need to put the resources at work as early as possible.
And it does take a toll on the family. We heard from Barbara. She wrote, "My husband and I have been going through years of trials and tribulations. I am bipolar, and he had an affair. The other woman was really pushing him to divorce me when we and I were most vulnerable. Then he had a heart attack. I'm just wanting feedback on how mental illness can cause affairs and divorce. We're trying to work on things to salvage our marriage, which is 3 decades old." So, Lewis, this mental illness can take tolls on families, on friends, loved ones. What have you observed?
Well, that's a not unfamiliar story, what the person just wrote in. And, of course, having a major mental illness in a family can be really disruptive and stressful and difficult, and especially if the person is not connected to services, either because they don't see the need for it or there's not the right service for them. One of the challenges I often hear from families of a loved one with a mental illness is they don't see that they have the problem, and they don't feel the need for services, and then consequently they'll say, "But we're family members. We see how sick they're becoming, and the legal threshold for us is that somebody has to be confirmed to be a danger to themselves or others." And with that determination, you could involuntarily hospitalize someone. But short of that, we sometimes have people who are very ill and very frustrated and stressed out families who don't know how to help them because they refuse to get help. there are some really positive things, I think, that are happening as I was listening to Sarah talk as well. We have hopefully some growing peer support services. So when someone feels that they can't talk or can't connect to other people, that we'd have someone else with experience with mental illness themselves who could partner with a person and talk with them about their journey and how that may help them in their recovery. So there's things we can do. And I think as particularly as we get into young adults and adults with an illness like schizophrenia, I think having more options beyond hospital care, community-based options that are well-supported would really help reduce stress on families and bring down the kind of conflict that the texter was talking about.
I'd like to add that in our family, there are siblings. Matt has siblings. And when Matt got diagnosed with schizophrenia, one of my daughters, she's a psychology major, and it hit her hard because she knew that this was very serious. And, you know, her welfare, she has a family, she has little ones, and how does she deal with that? Now she has to separate to a certain extent from her brother to protect her family. And that was a challenge for me and my wife because no longer, you know, you have the holidays coming up. No longer was everybody going to be at the dinner table for Thanksgiving. So we decided to have two Thanksgivings. So it's that sort of thing that one other thing I'd like to say is medication. I was totally against medication. Mm-hmm. My wife would say, he's suffering. If medication can help, let's do it. But we had this. That was a rub between us big time because medications have serious side effects. Some of them do. So that could have drove us apart. But the realization was, you know, it's not our choice. It's our son's choice, and we have to respect that.
Sarah, how has your depression impacted the rest of your family?
I was just about to comment. Back to Barbara, who texted about the... about her marriage, about that was very, very difficult. I was unable to function as a wife or as a mother. And I ended up, because I couldn't drive, having to actually go to another town in order to get services. And so I had to leave my family. And and eventually got divorced. Had to do that. It wasn't an easy choice, but in order, I got a lot of support from my husband and still do, and goes both ways, and it turned out okay. I'm so thankful, but still a very difficult issue.
We're picking up on a new 7-part series from Erica Heilman of the podcast Rumble Strip called They Are Us that explores the mental health system in Vermont. It's airing on VPR this week, and today I'm joined by Sarah Holland. She owns the Rivers Bend Design Landscaping Company in Moortown, and she has lived with major depression since her early 30s. Also with us is Ron, who is the parent of an adult son with schizophrenia, and Lewis Josephson. He's president and CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat. And before we get back to our panel, let's listen to this from the They Are Us series. Alexis Kiriak is an artist, and Steve, a culinary worker, and they were interviewed by Erica Heilman for the podcast. They both have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and they talk about the role that work has played in their recovery.
You're separated from others, which is what schizophrenia does. It's an alienation. It's a feeling that you are living, but you can't have a life. You look at other people and say, they have it and I don't. You believe that you are unpalatable, that you are not worthy of happiness. You watch other people live and think, I'll never do that. So what would help is employment. Like Von Trapp, we worked at Trapp Family Lodge for 5 years doing housekeeping, and that was team that was through Voc Rehab. And my medication was monitored at first till finally I proved myself. And people who need people.
So what was that employment situation? What did that do for you?
Wonderful.
Why? Why? Why was that?
I had money in my pocket. Thank you. Poverty. Poverty is a big problem for all of us. And having the dignity of work, the dignity of having enough money to be able to have what you want rather than just be on the dole.
Can you talk about before work and after work in terms of how that affects your mood and your state of mind?
You didn't feel like doing nothing before work. You feel like you're the only one with a breakdown. You're the only one getting paranoid and all that. And you get low steam or whatever it's called. But once I started work, I felt really good about it. And anyways, I was not as paranoid as I normally was.
Why do you think that is?
Because you keep busy. Yeah.
And that busyness, what does that busyness do?
It keeps your mind occupied. And your body makes you feel really good. I got an apartment. I can turn the temperatures up or down. And it's, what is it, 2-bedroom apartment. Plus, it's a lot better making money. Yeah. I'm working for the senior center now. Yeah. I'm learning culinary arts. I'm learning how to do the bacon. Plus, vegetables, I'm doing those. I'm doing a real good job, too.
Has this work changed the way that you feel in the community that you live in the town, and the people who live around you?
Everywhere I go, they say hi, Steve, to me, even on buses and everything. The old people, and I don't remember half their names, but they say, well, I'm from the senior center, you know, stuff like that. Makes a big difference, you know, helping them out. Makes you feel good, too. And lots of them are real nice to you. I like that.
That's Alexis Kiriak and Steve discussing their role of work and helping them recover from their mental illness. Sarah, you own your own business. So how important is that gainful employment to your ability to cope with your depression?
Oh, it's everything. Steve and Alexis nailed it. It's how I feel about it, the self-esteem. It's the feeling worthy. But it was a while getting there. And it sounds great that I'm an entrepreneur and started my own business. But the only reason I did was that I couldn't work at another job. I couldn't do 8 hours a day. And I couldn't until probably I started the business in 2000 and got off from disability in 2009. And I couldn't I still wasn't working a full day. But it took me, I had to retrain from my nursing degree. I couldn't go back to that. So I went to VTC. And fortunately for me, 2004, I think, was the Disability Act. And I got accommodations at VTC so that I could take classes. But time limits were waived, and there were accommodations for how anxious I was, so it took. I did a degree in horticulture and landscape design in 6 years instead of two, but. So I started the business so that I could work just 1.5 hours a day if I needed to.
Ron, has your son had problems finding employment?
You know, at one point he looked for work, but he just couldn't really do the job. Only lasted a couple days, but it's the fact that. When you have something like schizophrenia or you're manic, your brain is on fire. You just think about, as a parent, you know, you have three kids in the car and the kids are saying, hey, are we there yet? Are we there yet? You know, and pretty soon you want to say, you know, be quiet, shut up. That's the way it is living with schizophrenia. There's voices galore, and you're answering every one of those voices 24/7. And when I tried to get my son's attention, I didn't realize that I was just another one of those voices. Yes. When he told me to shut up, I can't stand you. It really was coming from, I'm overloaded. I need to become stressless. And that's really the importance of meditation, not being able to tell your brain to shut off. And these people can't do it. It's so important. So he really couldn't change. The only time things got better, because I used to confront him, why are you talking in the mirror? No one's there. Why you're doing stupid things. You're swirling around. There's dishes that have to get done. I didn't get it. He was so busy with his inner voices that the only time things got better is when I changed. When I realized that when I changed the way I looked at a person with mental illness, the person I looked at changed. And that's profound. And it really, really is the case. And because of his mental illness and everything that we've gone through, I've become more compassionate. I've become more tolerant. And I'm much more grateful for what we have.
Lewis, I'd love for you to discuss that role of work in recovery and what Brattleboro Retreat does to help people find those jobs so they can recover.
Yeah, it's a great question. And thank you for those inspiring stories. And I also hear, Ron, about what a struggle it can be sometimes when somebody can't focus because of their illness. But the fact is that people with mental illness want to work just for all the same reasons everyone wants to work. They want, as you said, the money in their pocket. They want the esteem. They want the sense of purpose and structure in their lives. And we've learned in the field of mental health to use practices like the one developed at Dartmouth College called supported employment. And in the sort of old days of employment work within mental health community, we might say someone should get a volunteer job. And supported employment came along and said, no, we are going to try to place people in competitive work, which is what people want and what motivates people. So we have a lot that we can do. Somebody mentioned Voc Rehab Services. They're a great partner for us at the retreat. We're always referring clients there. We do a lot to try to get people, again, back out to the community and to work. At the retreat, most of our work, again, tends to be on the inpatient hospitalization side and day treatment side. We have some outpatient psychotherapeutic services. But we'll be working more with the designated agency for them to be plugging the person into competitive employment.
Let's talk to Kathy. She's calling us from New Haven. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi. I think the courage of the people that you're talking to today is amazing. I'm so impressed. And I was calling to say, when you talk about the availability of resources, 5 years ago, after I did some disaster relief work where I experienced some stress that exceeded my capacity. I ended up getting a referral from my psychologist to a psychiatrist, and it was as a special favor to the psychologist that I got in to see this woman. So this was in 2013, and I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder and PTSD. And I can tell you that for the past 5 years, anytime I've called my psychiatrist, her voicemail has said the same thing. I am not taking any new patients at this time. And so, you know, I just feel lucky. I just think it's dumb luck that I ended up sitting in front of somebody who could make the pain stop and who could write a prescription so that I could take a medicine that allowed me to function as on the inside as well as I appeared to be functioning on the outside. And I feel bad for the people in Vermont who don't have that good luck. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. Lewis, how do we get that help? What are the best ways to look for it? I'd go online, just search. I don't even know what I would do if I needed the care. So where do people find that care that they absolutely need now?
Well, it's a huge challenge. The retreat has the largest staff of psychiatrists, for example, in the state of Vermont, and we're always have more demand than we can meet every single day. And there's a national crisis of psychiatrists sort of leaving the profession, retiring, and not enough new younger psychiatrists coming in. So there's a national shortage. What we've done in Vermont, what we've done at the retreat, is try to stretch our resources in a number of ways. One is through telemedicine. So we are trying to support other hospitals in Vermont with our telepsychiatry services. So if they have someone in an emergency department, we'll be able to consult and interview the person and make some treatment recommendations while they're waiting for an inpatient bed. So we use telemedicine. I think there's a bigger role for telemedicine in the state to stretch our psychiatric resources. The other thing we do at the retreat and in just about every community in Vermont is work with what's called the Blueprint for Health. And that is a sort of a team of providers and organizations on the ground level in your county that work with primary care and other care managers to try to get care out again in primary care through sort of an organic health system as opposed to coming to a specialty provider who may be overwhelmed. So what we do at the retreat is we'll go to a primary care physician's office, we'll consult with them on patients they're concerned about, and we will try to, again, help the primary care doctor do the best they can with prescribing, and because primary care can prescribe psychotropic medicine with support. So we're trying to be creative here in Vermont, but I would agree with the caller. It is an ongoing shortage and a struggle, not just here in Vermont, but nationally.
Go right ahead.
I just like to follow up a little bit with that comment. And it's what comes to my mind is falling through the cracks. And I think primary care and having mental health practitioners be embedded in primary care offices is a wonderful idea. Actually, Washington County Mental Health Services is working on that and getting getting far with that. But it's gets back to the point of everybody being different and how accepted they feel and how afraid they are. And so you, I felt tremendously paranoid when I'd go into my primary care doctor, and have had a lot of help, a lot of trouble with getting them to believe me, because I was presenting as a very capable person, and so something must be, you know, I must be lying. I must be what's my agenda? You know, so. So I didn't really trust him, and I wasn't getting any help. So who are, you know, what happens when people with mental health disabilities, when they don't even feel like they can bring up a difficulty?
Trust is huge, absolutely huge. And the problem with the healthcare system a lot of times is there's so much turnover. Mm. So once you get used to one person, they're gone. And for somebody who's mentally ill, trust is everything. And one thing that we've always told our son is, no matter what happens, we got your back. We're always there. That's the only thing that you can say, because we don't have the answers. You know, my wife said it to our son, this is bigger than me. If I knew how to fix this, I would. We need to go elsewhere.
I'm joined by Sarah Holland of Moortown, who has lived with major depression since her early 30s. Ron, who is the parent of an adult son with schizophrenia, and Lewis Josephson, he's president and CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat. And we're hearing real stories regarding mental health, treatment, and recovery, and how Vermont is doing in dealing with these issues. MyPad is a residential program run by the Howard Center that opened in 2012, and it's the only permanent supervised housing for chronically mentally ill people in the state. In They Are Us, MyPad's director, Graham Parker, talks about how the program works and why it's important, but also points out that the number of people the program is able to serve is minuscule compared to how many people could benefit from it.
The proportion that a place like MyPad serves is a fairly small proportion of the people who are in need. We have 7 beds, and they're permanent beds, so 4 or 5 of the 7 beds in total have not been back to hospital. It's quite miraculous. And then there's 2 or 3 have gone back to hospital, but the nice thing is that they have somewhere to return to, so we can cut the hospital stays a lot shorter because we continue to be in contact with them. We support them. We have agreements for what it would take for them to come back and do better next time. But having that extra support around, whether it's playing cards in the middle of the night or whether it's going bowling the next day, to know that they have somebody to go and talk to in the middle of the night if they're starting to get manic. And not to be lonely is very important. Loneliness is such a cause for so much angst for people and source of anxiety that can provoke worse problems.
That's MyPad's director, Graham Parker. Lewis, what options are there for those who can't live on their own?
Well, not enough. I would agree. We need more beds. If I had my magic wand to do the one thing right now for the system, I would add more supported residential beds. I think part of the reason we don't goes to stigma about mental health. I was talking to someone the other day, and I said, you know, we're also used to assisted living, right? If your grandmother or your mom's getting older and you're worried they're not going to take their medication or leave a pot on the stove, we're all just completely fine with the idea of assisted living. Help them to be as independent as they can be, but give them extra support so they're safe and healthy. We don't have that sort of attitude towards people with mental illness. So for Ron, whose son suffers from schizophrenia, that's the kind of person with a supported residential community of people that would make a huge difference. And as the segment from the show said, keep people out of the hospital. So more supported residential, I'd say, would be a priority. And I just think the reason we don't have it is because we have a stigma towards people with severe mental illness, and we do not say to them like we would to somebody with a medical failing that, you know, we're going to take care of you and keep you as independent as possible.
And Ron, I think you've expressed concerns about when you're not here any longer to help your son, right?
Of course. You know, it's so I guess what I wish for, because it's not the responsibility for the rest of my family to look after our son. They have their own lives. So you try to make him as independent as possible. You try to socialize him as much as possible and make those connections. And what I wish is that he just knows where to go to get the help when we're not around any longer.
Let's take another call. Bradley is calling us from Charlotte. Hi, Bradley. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, Bradley.
I've suffered through PTSD symptoms and dissociative identity disorder some 30 years ago, and have been able to recover to a very functional point. And am now facing a spouse that is headed down that same dark journey that with the light at the end of the tunnel. And although I can be very compassionate and empathetic, having understood it subjectively, I'm struck with the need for resources, particularly we have applied for disability for her. We haven't heard back yet. It is affecting us dramatically financially. And she presents as pretty capable and functional, but by all means, she has not been able to keep a job. She's been let go from two jobs in a row because of emotional instability. And we're really struggling to try to find resources. She has a therapist. She has a psychiatrist. She has a group that she goes to, but doesn't seem to be recovering. And it seems to me that the psychiatrist just keeps throwing more medication at her. And it's gotten really frustrating with some of the symptoms that have come back. I'm seeking resources, where to go from here.
Lewis, can you help?
Yeah, you know, I hear the caller and I feel for him on two different levels. One is, again, it's another situation where family who knows the person best sees them struggling and understands, in this case, how impaired they are. But the larger system is not able to help them. And so the threshold for someone to get on disability because of a mental illness is high. It's a federal disability benefit. And so as impaired in some ways as the person might be, the federal government might say, sorry, that just doesn't raise up to the point where we're going to provide disability payments. So that's a huge frustration. I also really hear the struggle with medication and trying to get the right level of services. And, you know, if anything, after 30 years in the field as a clinician, I am more humbled by people and listening to people more carefully than ever before and understanding when we get to recovery, and we always talk about recovering from a mental illness, just how individual that is, just how unique the road to that recovery is. I know and I've seen and see every day people recover from mental illness, but there's lots of ups and downs and struggles, and we still struggle with, you know, not having kind of curative slam dunk medication treatments and other treatments that just turn people around. So that pathway, I hear the caller, and I'm so sympathetic to that. But know that, you know, your psychiatrist, your therapist, we're doing our best within our power to try to help that person, and the road is often a twisting road.
I'd like to add that you know, family members are very, very important because I'm an expert on my son. You know, yeah, the doctor went to school. He has all the background. But I know what is wrong and right, especially when it comes to medicines, you know, his behavior. In my son's case, he was on one particular medicine. We didn't realize it at the time, but it made him walk constantly, 30 miles at a time. I'd get a call. I'm in, you know, I'm down by Charlotte. Can you pick me up? And this happened over and over and over again. And subsequently, he got in trouble with the law because of that. So after spending a while on CHEP 6, his medication was changed. And he's on the right medication. Now, for 2.5 years, he's fine. I would be interested if Lewis could comment on genetic panels. There's
That's a big question.
Yeah,
and you
sure is.
You threw it to Lewis at the end of our show. And unfortunately, we're going to have to look into that for a future show. I want to, first of all, thank everyone who's called in today. I'm sorry we didn't get to all your calls. I appreciate that you were going to share your stories. And I want to thank our panel. Sarah Holland owns the Rivers Bend Design Landscaping Company in Moortown. She's now on the board of Washington County Mental Health Services. Ron is the parent of an adult son with schizophrenia. He tried to take over the show right here at the end. And Lewis Josephson is the president and CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat. Thanks to all of you for being a part of this and being so open today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.